With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City Newsday. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for turning on the radio this morning and joining us for some agriculture news. Today is Thursday, July 20th. Coming up in today's show, we have an in-depth look at NAFTA and the renegotiations and what agriculture thinks about it. But first, we're starting off this morning with Brian German.
Sorghum producers in California are making progress in their fight against the sugarcane aphid. Early detection is the most important aspect of managing the pest, and researchers are suggesting growers scout their fields at least once a week. Once the aphid is found, they're advocating insecticide treatment at a threshold of 50 aphids per leaf. Nicholas Clark is an agronomy and nutrient management farm advisor covering Fresno, Kings, and Tulare counties. He talked about the products used for seed treatment that are showing positive results in combating the pest.
I'm actually really impressed with our growing community here. One of the big calls that I kept getting early on this year was about seed treatment. There are two products, imidacloprid and clothianidin, that seed producers are coating the sorghum seed with, and that's shown in the other states to provide up to 40 days of protection from the pest. And it's really the early growing stages that make the sorghum crop especially damaged by this pest.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West.
The White House released its objectives for the renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement. There were not a lot of surprises in the document, with heavy emphasis placed on reducing trade deficits with Mexico and Canada. One of the biggest goals that agriculture wanted was to maintain duty-free status on agricultural exports to Mexico and Canada, something included in the plan released on Monday. An AgriPulse report says the 18-page summary of objectives also includes the need to eliminate non-tariff barriers to U.S. agricultural exports. The administration also wants to promote greater regulatory compatibility to reduce burdens associated with unnecessary differences in regulation. That may be good news for U.S. dairy producers who are upset over Canada's pricing policy that hurts American cheese exports and other dairy products. The U.S. Trade Representative's plan also wants negotiators to find a way to prevent sanitary and phytosanitary barriers from blocking exports. Those kinds of barriers have been preventing America's potato farmers from expanding exports further into Mexico. The new plan stresses the administration's goal of updating and strengthening the rules of origin laws. However, it does not ask for a reinstatement of country of origin labeling on beef and pork imports from Mexico and Canada. We'll have more on NAFTA later in this show. What is slowing down the adoption and use of new data technology by farmers? Some say it's not the technology itself. Gary Crawford has this report.
What's keeping farmers from fully using technology to gather data and to use that farm data?
Privacy, security, and ownership.
The lack of trust among farmers in these ag technology providers.
One problem we have is rural broadband.
Internet access.
The voices of farm technology and legal experts testifying this past week at a House Ag Subcommittee hearing, and that last obstacle was mentioned by all of them. Roger Royce is a California lawyer whose firm tries to connect farmers with technology companies. He said the costs of things like remote crop sensors are coming down, but these sensors can't send the data anywhere without a large broadband capacity.
Each sensor is its own internet user. In other words, it's not daisy chained. It's each sensor has to load up to the cloud. That requires a tremendous amount of internet access,
which some farmers don't have. And Indiana ag lawyer Todd Jansen says it's not just that one farmer has it and another competing farmer down the road does not.
We should always keep in mind that our farmers are operating in a global market.
So he says the U.S. needs to invest in connecting all U.S. farmers to broadband so that our farmers can compete with farmers overseas who are rapidly adopting new technologies, bringing us to other reasons that many of our farmers are skittish about the new data technology. Now, yes, many farmers have tractors and such that are collecting all kinds of data from agronomic to economic. However, many producers are not doing anything with it because they don't trust people with that data.
This trust issue is a real issue.
Roger Royce said that in some cases, the mistrust is justified. He outlined a scenario in which a person collects data on somebody's farm, maybe using a drone up there or maybe hacking into the data on yields.
Or maybe financially. I'm going to figure out how profitable that farm is. And then I'm going to take that data and I'm going to go sell it to the companies that sell the inputs to the farm because they know how profitable the farm is. Or maybe I'll go sell it to one of that farmer's neighbors so he can come and, you know, he knows what that farm is worth, or maybe I'll sell it back to the owner of the land.
Ouch. Or maybe it's the government a farmer might not trust, as Texas cotton producer Billy Tiller put it.
I mean, what would keep EPA from wanting to just subpoena my records around? I'm in a watershed, so there's a lot of caution.
One more reason for caution is that when farmers do decide to trust their data to a data management and storage company, the contracts can be very complex. Todd Jansen says, yes, farmers sign contracts all the time.
But now they're being asked to check an I accept box, followed by pages and pages of legal type that they may or may not read.
So all of this is hampering adoption of new farm technologies. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Washington.
The House GOP released its budget this week, calling for $10 billion in spending cuts to agricultural programs through the next 10 years. However, Politico's Morning Agriculture Report says the plan does not necessarily say how to go about getting that number. It does recommend reining in supplemental nutrition assistance program spending by promoting state flexibility, but it doesn't go into any further detail on how to do that. While agriculture won't be happy with the spending squeeze given that farm income is down so sharply, the $10 billion is actually much lower than the $70 billion initially proposed. Politico says it now appears that House Ag Chair Mike Conaway will be given the flexibility he needs to write a farm bill. The wiggle room in putting the farm bill together will likely make it a lot easier for the House and Senate to get on the same page when it comes to putting the nation's farm programs together. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I am your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Banter Miticide presents Might Banter.
Whoa! Would you look at the living space on this almond leaf, Martha?
But you know we'll need to redecorate. The color scheme is very dated.
It's green, honey. It's a leaf.
Don't let mites take up residence in your almond orchard. Knock them down fast with new Banter Miticide from UPI. Banter is formulated to control the most damaging mites and keep them away for weeks. To learn more, contact your PCA or UPI representative today.
Don't let fire ants ruin the value of almond crops. Get long-lasting control of fire ants and other protein-feeding ants with a steam ant bait from Valent. Worker ants carry a steam ant bait back to the queen. Once there, the powerful activity prevents the queen from laying eggs and stops existing larvae from becoming adults. With no new worker ants, the entire colony is effectively wiped out, leaving orchards ant-free for months to come. To learn more, talk to your PCA or go to valent.com/esteemantbait. Always read and follow label instructions.
Get control of flies on your dairy operation with an integrated pest management program built around Clarifly Larvicide and Starbar products from Central Life Sciences. Clarifly Larvicide offers feed-through control that prevents the emergence of nuisance flies from the manure of treated animals by as much as 96%. And Starbar features a lineup of baits, traps, and sprays that address fly problems in all areas of your dairy operation. Flies can spread disease and lead to decreases in milk quality and yields. Learn how to limit their impact at starbarproducts.com. Attention California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. Make plans now to attend the 26th Annual Citrus Expo, August 16th and 17th in Fort Myers, Florida. The latest in citrus research and data, including advances against HLV, will be presented over a dozen seminars. More than 165 exhibitors will be showcasing their newest products, services, and technologies for the citrus industry. Don't wait, pre-register now at citrusexpo.net. That's citrusexpo.net.
I'll take dig a little, learn a lot for 30 bushels.
Soft and crumbly. Tom.
How does healthy soil feel to the touch?
Correct.
Dig a little for 40 bushels.
Sweet and earthy. Tom.
What does healthy soil smell like?
Yes. Go again.
Dig a little for 50 bushels.
Dark, porous, and alive. Tom.
What does healthy soil look like?
You win.
Understanding the basics and benefits of healthy soil can make your farm a winner too, through lower input costs, better yields, and drought protection, which can lead to a healthier bottom line for your business. Contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office today to find out how you can unlock the secrets in your soil.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. Winter wheat, spring wheat, what's the status of it all, especially as the drought takes its toll on the spring wheat crop? Here's Rod Bain.
Seth Meyer, chairman of the World Agricultural Outlook Board, says the latest USDA crop report showed a mix of impacts for wheat.
The winter wheat yield, which is the bigger portion of the area, came in, I think, probably a bit higher than trade expectations. So there's a little bit more winter wheat. Now, on the other side of that, they took down Durham and other spring wheat yields.
He notes this is USDA's first survey-based look of Durham and spring wheats for this year.
They were low, not maybe in line with trade expectations, but they were low. So what you again have is a mix of, you had a little bit more winter wheat and a little bit less of the spring wheats. And we've seen the spring wheat prices rising substantially.
One factor in the higher prices may be that there is expected to be a smaller amount of good quality spring wheat this year.
We're significantly below the crop conditions that we've seen over the last 5 years. We're about 35% of the crop is good to excellent. That's down from 70% last year. Of course, last year was a record year.
That was USDA chief economist Rob Johansson.
We still expect the yield to be second highest on record for the winter wheat crop at 49.7 bushels an acre.
He notes how the USDA figures released last week stack up against trade expectations.
We're at 1.76 billion bushels, down 25% year over year. That's right in line with trade expectations for all wheat, although when we look at the classes separately, we're running pretty high relative to trade expectations for the winter wheat, and we're at the low end of the trade expectations for the Durham.
Ag Board Chair Meyer points out there are important differences between winter wheat and spring wheat.
You've got different markets for wheat, and you've got different concerns about protein. So spring wheats, which tend to be higher in protein. So you can see these wheats move. So they're not perfect substitutes for each other.
Meanwhile, the drought that is hitting spring wheat planting in Montana and the Dakotas has so far not hurt wheat farmers in Minnesota.
Oh, and that's the other thing NASH showed from their spring wheat perspective, that they were, I believe, expecting record yields for spring wheat in Minnesota. So that's very, again, fortunate if you're a grower in Minnesota who's going to see both a high price and probably a good yield.
Spring wheat makes up about one quarter of overall U.S. wheat production. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Well, in today's livestock news, the Alabama Department of Agriculture and Industries did confirm they are working with USDA officials to address a positive test for atypical BSE in an 11-year-old Alabama beef cow. Here's Alabama State Veterinarian Dr. Tony Frazier.
Yes, Randall. It speaks to the efficiency of the surveillance system. That system does work. Our net is cast pretty broad in Alabama. We test a lot of on-farm animals that have died that are target animals. So the surveillance system is working, and we do hope that this is an event that will be a long time again before it repeats itself.
And I know you don't release information of where this cow came from, but I take it the herd that it was a part of, you all are monitoring that herd pretty closely right now.
Well, that's a good question. And actually, the animal was originated on the farm of origin. That's where she was born. They have excellent records. They are cooperating very well with us. We will be looking back at this cow's offspring and her birth cohorts and be monitoring those animals. As you know, there's no live animal test for atypical BSE. And so we will be monitoring those animals. They represent a low risk, but we do have excellent records, excellent cooperation from the herd of origin.
An atypical BSE case means it's rare and spontaneous incident. The animal was discovered during a routine surveillance at an Alabama livestock market. The animal never entered slaughter channels and in no time presented a risk to food supply or human health. And following delivery to the livestock market, the cow did die at that location. Dr. Jack Shear, USDA's chief veterinarian, talks about the many levels of BSE prevention and detection that have been put in place over the last few years.
We remove specified risk materials or parts of the animal that might contain the BSE protein prion and possibly transmit the disease from animals presented at slaughter. So those all animals that go to slaughter have these materials removed. The second safeguard that we follow is a strong feed ban, which prevents mammalian protein from being fed back to any type of ruminant. And another important component of our system is, of course, our ongoing surveillance program that allows USDA to detect the disease if it exists at very low levels in cattle populations. We used to sample up to 40,000. We're currently sampling 25,000 animals per year, and we're well above the standard set by OIE for that type of surveillance.
And Alabama's Dr. Frazier says that the surveillance system does work.
At no time did this cow enter the food chain. Our food supply, certainly the beef supply, is the most safe, wholesome source of beef protein in the world. We are confident in that, and this system proves that, because this animal did not go into the food supply, and our surveillance system is working very well.
I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
Well, it's been just over 10 years since the start of what became known as colony collapse disorder. What some thought was a U.S. problem turned out to be a worldwide disaster. So where are we now? Still looking, still searching for a solution. We've learned that bees aren't the only pollinators, but they do pollinate one-third of the plants we eat. In 10 years, we've learned that losing 15% of a farmer's total bee operation a year could be managed, but losses have been closer to 30%. What else have we learned? Well, other pollinators are more active since bee losses spiraled. But one report showed that all the other pollinators combined do about half as much good as the honeybee. So, the search for a solution goes on. Two major factors: find the cause of CCD and improve the environment. Only then will the problem be solved. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
This week, members of the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Trade held a hearing on modernizing the North American Free Trade Agreement. Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kine says the U.S. has recently made some missteps on the trade policy by not embracing the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement.
I think it's desperate that this Congress leans in now to try to get trade back on the rails in light of the dysfunction and the conversation that took place in last year's presidential campaign and the start that we have so far this year. And hopefully this will tee up some additional hearings so we can continue to get feedback and also hold this discussion of how we can get back in the game. You know, and I'm all for NAFTA renegotiation and trying to modernizing it, bringing it into the 21st century in light of the deficiencies of the current agreement. But, you know, these renegotiations, these one-off bilaterals only get you so far. You know, it's in the multilateral context where you have certain synergies and trade-offs that you normally don't get in bilateral negotiations. And that's why at a previous hearing not so long ago in this committee, I said that our rejection of trying to find a path forward with the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement will go down as one of the great strategic mistakes that we made as a country in the 21st century. And how we get back in that tent in the fastest growing economic region of the global economy, the Pacific Rim, is going to be very, very important for our own economic well-being, but also diplomatically in the national security interests that we have in that region as well.
Kind has some advice for the Trump trade team on behalf of the U.S. dairy industry.
Mexico right now is the greatest dairy export market that we have. So my advice to the new Trump trade team was, first, no trade wars. It's only going to hurt all of us here in the Western Hemisphere. And secondly, let's try to take what was accomplished in the TPP agreement and build upon that. And it seems as if they're starting to embrace that concept of not trying to recreate the wheel, seeing what these countries have already agreed to do in the context of TPP, which was also embracing core labor and environmental standards as a in the body of the agreement, fully enforceable like anything else that's in the agreement, and go from there. And I think that would be a wise approach.
Patrick Ottensmeyer, CEO of Kansas City Southern Railroad, was recently picked to head a group of corporate leaders focused on trade between the United States and Mexico. He told the subcommittee about the importance of the Mexican market for grain trade.
60% of our cross-border movement of freight is export. Is southbound, and the vast majority, the largest single commodity by a long margin is grain. Mexico is the second largest importer of corn in the world. We move about 35% to 40% of all Mexican grain and mostly yellow corn imports move on our railroad. And if you visualize a map of our rail network from St. Louis to Kansas City, down through Shreveport, Houston, across Laredo into the heart of Mexico. We are a perfect pipeline for moving U.S. agriculture, food products, grain, corn, soybeans from the major producing regions down into Mexico. And I would say that without the investment that we've made, building the capacity on our cross-border network, those products couldn't move in the quantities that they move today. A truck and other means of transportation large bulk commodities, rail is really the best and most efficient way to move. And I think we have been critical to open up those markets for your constituents and those in the Midwestern states into Mexico.
Humans Inc. Chairman and CEO Tom Linebarger spoke about the more efficient and effective regulations regarding cross-border trade.
Oftentimes the big elements of a trade deal get all the attention, and it's the small parts like lines at the borders where trucks get stuck for hours and hours or days at a time that actually stop the economy from moving. So that's one of the emphases we put at the Business Roundtable where I participate is how do we work out some of the smaller issues that, or at least the things that seem smaller, that could actually add to our economy with no cost to any of the sides by just being more efficient. So there are significant opportunities there using technology, as you mentioned, to reduce the burden on all sides and improve economic activity across the three regions. And I think that should be a clear follow-on from whatever NAFTA agreement is finally reached.
For more than 20 years, the North American Free Trade Agreement has tied the continent's economy together. Now the U.S. wants to give the trade deal a massive overhaul, beginning with talks this summer. United States Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer this week released a broad summary of objectives that will underpin the Trump administration's trade talks with Mexico and Canada for the renegotiation of NAFTA. Although the document is vague, it does single out areas where the U.S. may seek concessions. They include, the U.S. says, it aims to improve the U.S. trade balance and reduce the trade deficit with NAFTA countries, either by increasing American exports or by reducing Canadian and Mexican exports. Canada's supply management system for dairy and poultry could face closer scrutiny. And the U.S. wants to see Ottawa increase the amount Canadians can buy from the U.S. without paying duties to $800. Another priority is better access for the U.S. firms to sell U.S. products and services into the NAFTA countries. President Trump commented on Monday.
In just a few moments, I'll be signing a presidential proclamation to launch Made in America Week and to make today Made in America Day. We are thrilled to be joined today by so many incredible members of my cabinet. Every member of my administration shares the same goal: to provide a level playing field for American workers and for American industry.
The earliest NAFTA talks can legally begin is August 16th. That's 90 days after Mr. Lighthizer gave notice to Congress about the administration's plans to revisit the trade deal. No specific date or location has been set for the first round of talks. On the first day of marathon public hearings on the renegotiation of NAFTA, which was June 27th and held in the offices of the United States Trade Representative in Washington, Kevin Schoons of North Dakota, a leader of the National Corn Growers Association, said that exports account for fully one-third of corn farmers' income. American corn exports to Canada and Mexico have increased more than sevenfold since 1994.
Trade has been a central driver of growth of the U.S. agriculture economy. I cannot stress enough how important export markets are to our ability to stay in business.
Agriculture accounts for a relatively small part of the GDP of NAFTA members, but it could be one of the thorniest topics in the renegotiation talks due to start in August. Farmers did not ask for a renegotiation, according to David Salmonson of the American Farm Bureau, America's largest farm lobby. He says the group would like it to be updated and tweaked. Earlier access to the Canadian dairy and poultry market, which is protected by high tariffs and quotas on production, would be welcome. The National Farmers Union is asking President Trump to, quote, act in the best interest of U.S. cattle ranchers by reinstating country of origin labeling in the so-called NAFTA 2.0 negotiations. We will continue with our in-depth look at NAFTA right after this. This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm Sabrina Hill, and we will be back in just a moment.
Batter Miticide presents Might Batter.
Oh, would you look at the living space on this almond leaf, Martha?
But you know, we'll need to redecorate. The color scheme is very dated.
It's green, honey. It's a leaf.
Don't let mites take up residence in your almond orchard. Knock them down fast with new Batter Miticide from UPI. Batter is formulated to control the most damaging mites and keep them away for weeks. To learn more, contact your PCA or UPI representative today.
Don't let fire ants ruin the value of almond crops. Get long-lasting control of fire ants and other protein-feeding ants with a steam ant bait from Valent.
worker ants carry a steam ant bait back to the queen. Once there, the powerful activity prevents the queen from laying eggs and stops existing larvae from becoming adults. With no new worker ants, the entire colony is effectively wiped out, leaving orchards ant-free for months to come. To learn more, talk to your PCA or go to valet.com/esteem ant bait. Always read and follow label instructions.
Get control of flies on your dairy operation with an integrated pest management program built around Clarifly Larvicide and Starbar products from Central Life Sciences. Clarifly Larvicide offers feed-through control that prevents the emergence of nuisance flies from the manure of treated animals by as much as 96%. And Starbar features a lineup of baits, traps, and sprays that address fly problems in all areas of your dairy operation. Flies can spread disease and lead to decreases in milk quality and yields. Learn how to limit their impact at starbarproducts.com.
This is Farm City Newsday. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. We'll be right back with more of the news that's important to you.
Attention California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. Make plans now to attend the 26th Annual Citrus Expo, August 16th and 17th in Fort Myers, Florida. The latest in citrus research and data, including advances against HLB, will be presented over a dozen seminars. More than 165 exhibitors will be showcasing their newest products, services, and technologies for the citrus industry. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net. That's citrusexpo.net.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We continue now with our in-depth look at NAFTA. Steve Nelson, Nebraska Farm Bureau President and member of the AFBF Trade Advisory Committee, responds to the administration's recently announced objectives for NAFTA renegotiations. Chad Smith has more.
As the administration begins negotiations to update NAFTA, Nebraska Farm Bureau President Steve Nelson, a member of the AFBF Trade Advisory Committee, says the administration's objectives will maintain and build on the gains NAFTA has brought U.S. agriculture.
NAFTA has been very beneficial to farmers and ranchers across the country and in Nebraska as well. We've seen annual exports to Mexico and Canada grow from approximately $8.9 billion in 1993 to over $38 billion in 2016. So that really tells a big story about how important this trade agreement has been for producers all across the United States.
While the agreement has been an overall boon to U.S. agriculture, Nelson says that modernizing NAFTA could address some issues for farmers and ranchers.
Continued elimination of some of the tariffs, particularly as it relates to Canada on dairy, poultry, and eggs, would be an area that we would like to look at. We'd also like to take a look at some of the areas that relate to geographical indicators and biotechnology that could be revised in the NAFTA agreement. There's a lot of things that have changed in the last 20 years, particularly as it relates to new technologies. And so we need to make sure that the trade agreement takes those kinds of things into consideration.
Nelson says when barriers are removed and the playing field is leveled on both sides of the borders, trade improves and each country involved benefits.
That's really what we want to continue to see in the future is a trade agreement that is good for both sides. So we will continue as we work with the negotiators and as we work with the administration to take another look at NAFTA, that we may make sure that we protect the good things that we have in NAFTA and look at those things that we can improve to make NAFTA a better trade agreement.
Chad Smith, Washington.
And we wrap things up today on a lighter and tastier note. This is prime season for fresh plums and, of course, Gary Crawford's stale plum puns.
And now, yes, you know where this is going. So the kid sticks his filthy hand into his pie, starts pulling out stuff. Disgusting. But this serves as a very poor introduction for our subject about which we're talking today, plums.
We are talking plums.
We are out at the Ag Department's Farmers Market in Washington in the Vegetation Tent with Laura Popilski with the Agricultural Marketing Service. She's out here with a plum job, showing folks all about plums. And say, Laura, did you hear that sad story about plums? Yeah, it's pitiful.
Oh, that's a pitiful joke, Gary.
Oh, so it's a battle of plum puns now, is it? All right. But about plums themselves, Laura, they've been around along with the puns for a very long time, right?
Plums were first eaten and grown by the Syrians and the Romans and probably brought to Europe during the Crusades.
I seek the bravest knights in the land. Will you join me?
Ah, yes, they were all seeking the holy plum or something. But fast forward to North American colonial times.
And early settlers brought the European plum to the United States, and the Japanese plum was brought to California in the 1870s. Since then, plum production has not plummeted.
Plummeted.
I'm good.
Yeah, you are. So are plums. The European variety is used mainly for drying, processing. They're turned into prunes. It's the Japanese variety that most of us see at the farmers' markets and the grocery stores. But unlike some fruits, you know, I cannot tell if they're ripe or not by the color. So how do you pick a good one?
You want to give them a little bit of a squeeze, and they shouldn't be too hard, but they should give a little when you squeeze them. And you'll just want to avoid any ones that seem too soft or mushy or leaky. Those ones are overripe. You don't want to take those home with you.
Oh, no. I'd never take home a leaky plum. No.
No, because then you would need a plumber to fix your leak.
I got it. Yeah, to fix a plumber. Yeah, haha. Okay, now, Laura says that you can buy plums not quite ripe, take them home, and then what?
Put them in a brown paper bag for 2 or 3 days on your countertop. But if they're ready and you don't want them to ripen anymore, you can keep them in the fridge for up to a week.
And it would take a week for Laura to tell us all about the ways to use plums besides just taking a bite out of one.
I really like them grilled or sautéed.
Grill?
Oh, you could grill plums.
Why would I want to do that?
Why not? So grilling or sautéing plums. I'm going to sauté some plums today with butter, cinnamon, ginger, and a little bit of honey. And that would be great on a dessert, maybe some ice cream.
Mm.
Or it would be a neat side with grilled meat.
So, don't be dumb, eat a plum.
Don't be dumb, eat a plum. I like that.
Well, then there can't be much to it. Forget it. Besides, I'm a plum out of puns.
Well, you'd made those jokes with a plum, as far as I'm concerned. Is that good?
Yeah, that's the best one. You win. For some great recipes using plums, go online to What's Cooking at USDA. What's Cooking USDA, and type in plums. Yeah, in Washington, where you and I, Laura, are what?
Plum crazy.
Yeah, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.